Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast. A warm welcome to the show. So glad you're with me today. Bill Arnold here. I would call today Favorite People Thursday. I just made that up 2 seconds ago because I have some of my very favorite people on the show today. Dr. Kent Dunnington is going to be with me in just a minute. I see he's already on the studio line, so I don't want to spend a lot of time. He's written possibly my very favorite book on the subject of addiction. It's called Addiction and Virtue, Beyond the Models of Disease and Choice. And if you have questions, I asked Kent if he'd be willing to take some questions about addiction. And I know you have them because you know somebody that's been touched by it. Or maybe it's you, and you have a question. The best way to do is call us at 877-933-2484. We also have a text line, which is the same, 877-933-2484. But we are a live radio show, and I'd much prefer to hear your voice than I would get a text from you. I want more interaction with people via voice than text. But text would be acceptable. If you don't want to come on the show, you can just text the question, and I'll ask Kent on your behalf. Kent is just really one of the smartest guys I've ever spoken to, and I'm a pretty smart guy myself. I once solved a Rubik's Cube in 18 months, so I'm a pretty smart guy as well. So we're going to have a great conversation. And then also, Joanne Pittman's going to be on the program today, and then a whole hour with Dr. Mark Muska. So that's why I call it Favorite People Thursday. So we're going to take a little break and then get Dr. Dunnington on the show in just a minute.
Hi, I'm Ted Ross with the Faith in Life Minute. If you're feeling stuck or stagnant in your faith right now, listen to this encouragement from radio host and author Susie Larson.
Oftentimes we lose spiritual momentum when we start to look too long at ourself and our sins and our missteps. So if you want to jumpstart your faith again, I challenge you to refuse condemnation. The Bible says there is now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. So if you're in Christ Jesus, there's no spot, no stain on you. So refuse condemnation, but also reject rejection. Because Jesus has accepted you, his opinion matters more than others. And so it doesn't really matter if someone has an outdated opinion of you. Jesus has an updated opinion of you. Those two things, reject rejection and refuse condemnation, will put a spring in your step. Accept who God says you are. Walk in his favor and smile today because he loves you.
Hear more from Susie Larson and find links to her books at myfaithradio.com.
Thanks for tuning into the show today. I know you're going to have a great time listening to my guests. My first guest today is Dr. Kent Dunnington, and it's interesting when a philosopher decides to write a book about addiction because it's going to bring a perspective and an angle that you're not going to see coming. And it is the most compelling book I've read on addiction, and I co-host a show with George Fraser on a weekend about addiction, and I have a great heart for people who suffer from it, and I just, when I came across this book recommended to me by my my cousin Katie, who's a PhD in Rhode Island, I said, I found my guy. So he's now back on the show. We're going to take questions today. If you have a question, 877-933-2484 about addiction. Kent, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Yeah, so I want to just sort of set the table a little bit. The main argument of your book is that addiction is really neither a disease or a choice, but it's really just kind of a complex habit. Is that fair?
That's fair.
Good.
That is the view that I defend in the book.
Yeah, and I'll talk a little bit about that if you would, because I know we've got people that are going to be going, oh, wait a minute, I was genetically predisposed to addiction. That's why I have it. Or, you know, I just want to do what makes me happy. So, I mean, there's so many different perspectives. So if you can just fill in some of the blanks.
Yeah, sure. So I got interested in the question because of the sort of prominence of the disease paradigm for addiction I found it hard to square that way of thinking about addiction with the kinds of recoveries that I was seeing happen in typical 12-step groups, programs, and that sort of thing. And so I thought that some of the ways that people talked about addiction were incompatible. I came to understand through the course of study why the disease paradigm has been so important, and I think it has indeed produced a great deal of good. Chiefly, it's removed a lot of the stigma that is associated with addiction. But I still think that the arguments that are made in support of the view that addiction is a disease are weak arguments. You gave the example of a genetic predisposition, and that is indeed a common argument for the disease model. But the argument proves more than you would want it to prove, because if you perform some action, you are genetically predisposed. For that action becomes part of a disease complex, and it's going to turn out that all kinds of actions that you perform on a daily basis are part of a disease, because some of us are more genetically predisposed to happiness than others. Some of us are more predisposed to be religious, so on and so forth. Similarly, a common argument is that the use of certain drugs or certain kinds of addictive behaviors change the brain, and that is true. But that argument is often used as proof that addiction is a brain disease, whereas simply any kind of repetitive activity that human beings engage in brings about changes in the brain. So the more I looked into it, the more I thought, you know, the basic intuition that most people have, which is that addiction implicates human meaning and human choice, even in a way that disease doesn't. That basic intuition is right, but in order to see your way to it, you have to get free of the disease model of addiction.
Now, Kit, there's also people that will say, I've developed this disease. Oh, sure, I've made some bad choices, but I've developed this disease. Now it is so beyond my control. And, you know, our choices are never, we're always responsible for what we do, correct?
Yeah, well, there's certainly a grain of truth in that observation. I mean, people who are seriously addicted, rightly, I think that they no longer have a kind of pure autonomy over the decision whether or not to use or whether or not to engage in a certain kind of behavior that they had before they to engage in the practice of addiction. It's certainly true. Our are constrained and narrow by the what I call deep habits. But the mistake is to think that just because our wills have been significantly impaired, that therefore we actually are not voluntarily involved in any way in the behavior. In fact, this is what's so insightful, I think, about the category of habit, which is an old category and even a common sense category, but I think we don't often think about some of the implications of having a habit. And one of those implications is that once you have a habit, your ability to act otherwise is severely curtailed. So you have to undertake strategies, for instance, to act in ways that go against the habits you've developed. Mm-hmm. And I think something like that is true with addictions. Addictions just happen to be some of the most complex habits that human beings have, and furthermore, habits that are connected to our deepest centers of meaning-making. And I think it's because of the complexity and the connection to our search for meaning that addictions are so incredibly difficult to overcome.
Mm-hmm. Ken, let me ask, is the concept of an addict, how long has that been around? Is that an American idea, or has that been around forever?
It depends on what you mean by addict. Bill. If you mean, has the word been around, it has in fact been around for a long time. In fact, like the King James Version of the Bible, Paul uses the language of addiction as translated in the King James Version of the Bible to describe someone who's basically become a slave to Christ. So in that sense, addiction is quite old.
Okay.
But the notion of an addict as who has a compulsive need to use a substance is quite modern. It's actually developed in the wake of the American temperance movement and developed primarily by a guy named Benjamin Rush. He was a great medical doctor in Chicago, and he was the first one to really begin to sort of medicalize heavy drinking into a category called addiction.
All right, Kent, let me take a break. Dr. Kent Dunnington is my guest. It's 14 minutes after the hour. We'll return, and if you have a question for Kent, 877-933-2484. That's also a text. You can also text a question to that number, 877-933-2484. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. It's 16 minutes after the hour. Dr. Kent Dunnington is my guest. He's written a book called Addiction and Virtue, Beyond the Models of Disease and Choice. If you have a question, we'd be happy to take it. 877-933-2484. Again, 877-933-2484. Kent, let's talk about addiction as it being a form of counterfeit worship.
Yeah, in the book I talk about addiction is a form of counterfeit worship, and I even go so far as to suggest that addicted persons in modern society are almost like what I call unwitting prophets. That is to say, they point us to some deep, powerful need that we have as human beings that our contemporary society often fails to meet for us. The notion that addiction has to do with the deepest spiritual desires is not anything original to me. Carl Jung, for instance, famously said that it was no coincidence that strong alcohol was referred to as spirits, and he thought of alcohol and other kinds of strong intoxicants as tools that we use to experience a kind of ecstatic connection with something beyond us, because we're not able to get that the proper way. And so in the book, I argue that addiction is extraordinarily powerful in part because it appears for some time to meet very deep needs that we have that we might think of as spiritual needs or needs that we actually meet through genuine worship. Mm-hmm. For instance, to have a central defining ordering purpose to our life, the need to have an experience of ecstasy, which is to say an experience where I'm taken out of my little subjectivity and encompassed by and even dominated by something much greater than myself. Addiction opens people up to experiences that mimic the kinds of things that happen in powerful transcendent experiences. And so I do think of addiction as a form of counterfeit worship.
Mm-hmm. So if alcohol or chemicals come in and they alter and impair your brain, I guess I do see that as now you've developed a disease, almost like a damaged liver from drinking. Mm-hmm. So it's when we look at the choice and the disease models, and now let's say we want to try to do life differently, and I think you would say right thinking always has to come before right acting.
Well, sometimes, I'm sorry, you cut out a little bit there, Bill, but did you say, do I agree that right thinking has to always come before right action?
Yes.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, I think that one of the things that happens in lots of 12-step groups, for instance, is that people come there out of desperation. And they come there with a great deal of skepticism about the claims that are made by 12-step groups about the recovery process and about the nature of what they're struggling with. I think AA rooms and 12-step rooms are full of people who are quite confused, don't think clearly about what it is that they're struggling from. But AA, I think, wisely says, look, you don't have to agree with us. You don't have to have this all clear in your head. Just do these things and see if it works. And I think part of the brilliance of AA is it recognizes that very often what we think and even how we feel follows on the heels of how we act. And so the practices that AA invites its participants to perform, they are habituating practices. And the nice thing about habituating practices is you don't have to have a high level of confidence that they're going to work for them to work. Right. If they are successfully habituating practices, they might have the power to rehabituate you, to pull you into a different mode of life that can give you some critical from your addictive patterns.
That's so interesting, Ken, because I think that's absolutely true. I mean, you get into a new pattern, and whether or not you actually believe the pattern is going to make a difference, the pattern through repetition will make a difference. Can make a difference,
that's
I
right.
would say. Yeah.
That's right. I mean, one of the things that I have never wanted to communicate, I did write a book where I sought a lot of conceptual clarity about addiction, but I've never wanted to indicate that thinking about it rightly is the most important thing for recovering from it. Far from it. I mean, there are plenty of addicts who have studied their addiction all day long and all night long to a point of self-obsession, but they simply won't submit to practices that have been time-honored, shown over time to help.
Mm-hmm. What did you learn about 12-step programs and the candor and honesty that goes on in those, and what can churches learn from those groups?
I have a great deal of regard for the 12-step movement. I don't think that it's flawless by any means, and from the perspective of Orthodox Christian theology, it often leaves much to be desired in the way that it talks about God. However, there is a beautiful reality to, as you said, the candor and honesty that takes place in these rooms. And part of it is because it's modeled on a Protestant revival movement. It was known as the Oxford Movement. And that movement itself saw, much in the way that early Wesleyan confessional groups did, it saw radical authenticity and honesty as the tool by which God could reorient a person's life. And so Bill W., the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, himself had a powerful religious experience in a revivalist setting, and he came to believe that turning AA meeting rooms into the kind of setting where radical confession could take place was the only hope for the kinds of conversion necessary to pull people away from addiction. Now, I don't know if it is the only hope, but it has been shown to be one powerful way of reorienting people's lives. And I think, you know, one of my early experiences in AA was, well, why isn't the church a little bit more like this? I grew up in the church and was sort of led to believe that the church was supposed to be a place where you could be honest about yourself, but it so often wasn't. And I think the simplest explanation to that is that people in AA are desperate. They're willing to, they've already lost so much face. They're not there for social capital or anything like that. But so often in, you know, contemporary American church, there are other reasons for being there than genuine need.
Ken, what happens when a person in an active addiction, they know their behavior to be destructive, but they're just going to do it anyway? Do you have any insight to that?
It depends on, you know, the reasons. There are people, I think, in fact, I've known some, I've received letters from some in the wake of writing this book, who have tried to recover so many times that they've lost hope.
Mm.
And so they think that their way of life is destructive and it's going to kill them, but they really can't believe that they could find a way out. I think there are others whom they believe that they could find a way out, but that the deck is utterly stacked against them. So I think it's no coincidence that there's such a high rate of addiction among people who are homeless or who have – there's a homelessness, mental illness, and addiction are what doctors call COVID, but they often show up together. And I think part of the explanation for that is that if your prospects for living a life of flourishing are already extremely limited, if you, you know, do what society says you ought to do – And sometimes it really is rational, even though you know it'll kill you earlier, sometimes it really is rational to take a pill, you know, to calm the pain. And so I think there are people who, from the outside, it looks like they're utterly irrational and insane, but from the inside, it is really the best way of dealing with extreme pain and social dislocation.
Mm-hmm. Kent, we live in a world where there seems to be more and more boredom, loneliness, and then addictions can flourish in that environment, and everyone is looking for a way to change how they feel. Can you give some love and grace and counsel to some of the people that might be in that situation today?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things that modern society, which includes democratic forms of government, capitalism, what we think of as the whole process of globalization, it's brought a lot of good, and I don't want to be a critic of it. But one of the things that it has brought is enormously high levels of addiction. Levels of addiction that we haven't seen anything like in other cultures. And I think Bruce Alexander is a well-known psychologist who has argued for the view that the main driver of addiction is what he calls dislocation, which is the loss of community and other meaning-making systems that make us feel at home in the world. And so I think there's that one major component. And the other is what another friend of mine, Anna Lemke, who's a does addiction medicine at Stanford. She calls it the dopamine rainforest, which is that we are now, because of modern technology, surrounded, and there's just an onslaught of opportunities to engage in addictive behavior, whether that be drugs or the internet or whatever. So I think you bring those two things together and you just create a culture that's ripe for addiction. And if something like that's right, it means that the way to respond, way to be proactive to protect yourself against addiction is to be very careful about what you expose yourself to and to really work hard to develop forms of rich community and belonging so that you don't feel at a loss and dislocated in modern world.
Mm-hmm. And Kent, I suppose developing small little incremental steps, little new habits might help change you over time. I mean, sometimes you walk into a coffee shop and literally everyone is looking down at their phone.
That's right.
You can't even begin to have a conversation with somebody.
That's right. I just finished teaching a class last semester for my undergraduate students on addiction. And in an attempt to sort of figure out where addiction mattered in their life, I had them take what was called a cell phone compulsion test online, which you can find. And not surprisingly, all of my students, except one, tested as severely addicted to their cell phones. So in the course of the semester, we began a series of small incremental steps to try to wean them off their cell phones, and I did it with these students. And one of the things I realized is that very simple thing changes I could make would relieve me from constantly depending on my phone. So for instance, I took email off my phone, I took all apps off my phone on which I browse and fill all of my time.
Ken,
doing that has made a big difference.
Yeah, I hate to bail on you, but thank you so much for being on the show. I'd love to have you back on. You're just a gift.
All right.
Keeps on giving.
All right, you're welcome,
yep.
Bill.
Dr.
Take
Kent
care.
Dunnington's been my guest. We'll be back in a minute.
Prayer is not just about asking God to do stuff. Prayer is about fellowship.
One exciting part of our walks with God is learning how to talk with Him. Hi, I'm Steve Douglas for Making Your Life Count. And Jonathan Parnell says that prayer is important on many levels.
When it comes to the habits and the everyday stuff that we do, we have to ask, are we living like God is real? And I think when we don't pray, when we neglect prayer, that's in essence what we're doing. We are living our lives like God is not real. And there is that moment in prayer when you're on your face before God. It's in that moment when it's like, yeah, you are real. And the realness that I'm experiencing right now, I want that to infuse everything else that I do.
Do you want to learn more about walking closely with God? Go to makingyourlifecount.com.
Welcome back to the show. Bill Arnold here. I am in studio with Joanne Pittman. She is the vice president of China Source. She's a consultant, a trainer, a teacher, and she helps people prepare for effective cross-cultural living. She, I think, moved to China in 1984, but I'm going to get all the details correct once I get her on the air. She has worn many hats. She's been an English teacher, a Chinese language student, educational program director, and cross-cultural trainer. She currently, however, lives in Minnesota, so she doesn't live too far from the station, and she was nice enough to come in. Joanne, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So as a person who has lived cross-culturally, you've done so for, what, 30 years?
Yes, I went to China to work in 1984.
Okay.
And for what I thought was going to be 1 year of teaching English, and I moved back to Minnesota in 2012.
And 30 years, that's a big chunk of life.
Pretty much my adult life, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And I know that God blessed that experience in huge ways, and now you're helping equip people to have these kinds of living experiences.
That's correct. At China Source, what we try to do is provide objective information about the church in China, and we know there's a lot of people who are interested in China and interested in what God is doing there, and so we are trying to provide information, training, equipping, and so my passion is to help that next generation of people who want to serve China.
Sweet. Now, we're very interested in China. Everything about the news is China today and what's going on in our economy and in our world, but more importantly, we care about what's going on in the lives of the people of China and their souls. So maybe you could talk about what the current status is in China.
The church in China, I would say, the most important thing is that it's growing, and the church in China is actually quite strong. I think in the West, there's a dominant narrative of the Chinese church as predominantly a persecuted church, and historically that has been the case, and there still is some persecution and some pressure and harassment. But for the most part, I think Chinese Christians are very similar to Christians in the West. They're trying to figure out what it means to be a Christian in a secular society, in a society that's hostile, and how to raise their children as Christians, how to build strong churches, how to deal in a materialistic world. Very similar issues that we do have here.
Yeah, well, maybe we should start by putting it in a context of 30 years ago when you went in 1984. What was it like then, and how far have we traveled?
Well, it was very different in 1984. I went as an English teacher to a university in a small city of 2 million people.
Small city, 2 million?
In China, 5 million is a small city.
Really?
Yeah, so 2 million. And there was one church that was open at the time, and it had only been open for a couple of years. It had had to, from the mid-1960s to about 1980, all religious venues in China were closed. So there were no churches, no mosques, no temples. And that was beginning to change in 1984. So the city of 2 million had one church, and most of the people there were old people who had kind of come back after the era of it being closed. And I would talk to students, and they, you know, they'd heard of Christianity, but they really didn't know anything about it. And now in China today, almost all cities have fairly large churches that are registered and open and public, and more churches that are unregistered and sort of take place at the margins.
Mm-hmm. Were you fearing any kind of persecution when you were there in 84?
Not personally.
Were you there under the radar a little bit as an English teacher, and you couldn't really be too public about your faith?
Yeah, pretty much. I was with an organization that was invited by the Chinese government to send English teachers to China.
Mm-hmm.
And the organization was very public about the fact that everybody in the organization is Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And so we weren't pretending like we weren't Christians. But there was, we couldn't do anything publicly. The only type of ministry that we could do was just in the course of building relationships with our students and doing things one-on-one. I would say at that time, I was never fearful of persecution because if I crossed some line, you know, that the government didn't like, the worst that was ever going to happen to me was I was going to be asked to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, that never happened. But certainly our students back in the 1980s were very reticent about conversations. They were curious about Christianity because they really didn't know anything about it.
I would love to hear more about that. I mean, when you have a conversation with someone for the first time who has no real knowledge of God or background of being raised in a God-centered home, what's it like when you start to give them the good news of the gospel?
Well, it's interesting because you have to start at a different point. In the West, even though we're very secular, most people in the West at least know the basics of Christianity or at least believe in God. But especially in 1984, and this is still primarily true in China today, atheism is actually taught in the schools. So it's not just kind of something you choose from. It's actively taught. And so if you want to have a religious conversation with somebody, you have to start at the point of, does God exist? If you have conversations in the U.S., most people believe that God exists. But so you can't start with a, you know, God loves you and died for you,
right?
Because it's like, that's like saying to an to a Westerner, well, Santa Claus loves you and died for you. I don't believe in Santa Claus. It's not good news.
Yeah.
So a lot of there's a lot of, you know, pre-evangelistic work on wrestling through does God exist? That's where you have to start.
I do find it interesting that they teach atheism. That's got to be the shortest course in the world. God doesn't exist. Any questions? Now the final exam.
Pretty much.
I mean, seriously, what else do they say? What else do they say to reinforce the idea of atheism?
Well, they teach, you know, they teach Darwinism. So they go back, you know, evolution and Darwinism and all of that kind of.
So they have a substitute.
Yeah, they have a substitute. And then the Communist Party, really what it tries to do within the educational system is to say, you need to put your faith in us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'll take care of everything. We're going to make sure you're safe. We're going to make sure everything is good. And so you put your trust in us. And so the substitute is us. Now, interestingly, in China today, as China's become richer and Chinese people have more freedom and they're traveling around the world and the economic level, you know, China's now the second largest economy in the world. The belief system of Marxism is kind of fallen by the wayside. People will say they believe in it because that's the right answer. But most people in China today, if you ask them, what do Chinese people believe in, they'll say making money.
Interesting. Yeah, that's really interesting. So when you have a history, you went over there to teach and then you came back and then God called you to go back and live there?
Yeah,
that kind of how it worked?
Kind of.
Yeah.
I went, as I mentioned, I went in 1984. I just signed up with this organization to go and teach for one year. And I ended up staying a second year. And it was during that second year that I sensed God calling me to long-term work in China. And then I came back and I got a master's degree. And then I went back and studied Chinese and actually never went back to English teaching. I studied Chinese and then I directed a program for Americans who were studying Chinese. And then I got involved in doing training for the people in our organization who were coming over.
So I'm interested about brain plasticity because it seems that that's not only a big word, but it seems like it would be very difficult to learn Chinese as an adult. You know, maybe if you're an 8-year-old kid on the playground, you can learn it quickly. But when I think of trying to learn Chinese as an adult, back of my head almost explodes.
It wasn't easy, and especially when I was director of the program, you know, I would tell the incoming students that, because they would come in for 2 years, and I said, this is learning another language as an adult is the most humiliating thing you can do.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, little children on the street can communicate better than you can. So it is difficult, and Chinese is a particularly difficult language because of the writing system. But
did you learn to write?
I learned the basics of writing. I mean, I know how to write, but in order to write, you know, like a sentence or a paragraph or something requires the memorization of the characters.
Yeah.
And when I was studying Chinese, my goal was primarily to communicate. So I focused on listening and speaking.
Mm-hmm.
I can read Chinese. And for writing now with the advent of computer technology, I can send emails to my text messages to my friends in China in Chinese, but I'm not actually writing it out.
Okay. So now you've got a history of having a 30-year run in China. Talk about some of the fruitful relationships and some of the people who came to faith in Christ and maybe some of the ways in which they have turned around and become spiritually reproductive.
Mm. Well, one thing that I can think of is in the program that I was working in, we would hire tutors to help our Americans who were studying English. And quite a few of those tutors became Christians because they were working they were coming every day one-on-one with the Americans and getting to know them. And then in that context, we were able to share the gospel. And I can think of one young woman who came to faith. And she and her husband now are doing they're doing essentially evangelism and missions among a minority people down in southwest China.
That's fantastic. Yeah. I mean, those are some of my favorite stories. Yeah. God touches a life, and then they go out and they serve Christ with the rest of their lives. Mm-hmm. That's really powerful.
And I know of some others who were part of our program too that are either pastors or they're working in universities and, you know, as professors and reaching out to mm-hmm. their students as well.
Yeah. Joanne, we're going to take a break here just in about a minute or so, but I'm curious as to the kind of encouragement you could give a person like you 30 years ago that was thinking about it.
About going to China?
About going to having a cross-cultural experience.
Well, I would absolutely recommend it and, you know, be open to the Spirit's leading. And I think a lot of people are afraid of cross-cultural work, but there are a few things more exciting than living cross-culturally in a place where God has called you. And, you know, yes, you get stretched, you get pulled, you have to learn different ways of thinking and different ways of perceiving the world and, you know, understanding different worldviews. But I highly recommend it.
Yeah. Joanne Pittman is my guest. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we're going to continue our talk. And she's written a book called The Bells Are Not Silent, Stories of Church Bells in China, which I'm fascinated in, and I want to hear a little bit. I just want to get a tease from her about the book. We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute. Back to the show. Joanne Pittman is my guest in studio. We're having a lovely conversation. Joanne is vice president of China Source and has spent 30 years doing missionary. Is that right? Missionary work? What do we call it, Joanne?
We would say 30 years serving in China.
30 years serving in China. And she sort of was, while she was over there, she had an opportunity to make a little discovery about a bell, and that produced quite an interest in the bells of China.
Yes.
Did I say that right?
Yes.
Okay. So tease me a little bit about your book, The Bells Are Not Silent, Stories of Church Bells in China.
Okay. I'll tease you with the story of the discovery of the first bell.
Yeah, that'd be great.
I was in southwest China with Noel Piper from Bethlehem, mm-hmm. and we were doing research on a missionary from Bethlehem Baptist Church who had gone out to China in the 1920s, and we were just trying to research her legacy, and so we had all of her we had all of her newsletters and pictures and stuff. So we mapped out where we were going to go. We were at a city in southwest China at this church visiting with this pastor, and we were telling him what we knew about the history of his church, and he was telling us what he knew about it. And then he turned to us and he said, "You know, we have a bell in our steeple, and it has English writing on it, but we can't read it. Can you help?" So
yeah.
We climbed up into the steeple of the bell, and it's me and Noel and our Chinese translator. And we climbed up, and my friend Ben, the translator, he climbs up way, way up into the steeple. The pastor wouldn't let us go up because he was afraid we would fall. And he starts to read off the inscription on the bell. And I'm standing there with my notebook, and Noelle's got her little iPhone out. And he reads this bell, and it says, "Presented to the First Baptist Church of Coffeyville, Kansas, by W.S. Upham, 1863. Praise ye the Lord." And we just were dumbfounded. We looked at each other, and it was like, well, how did this bell get here?
Yeah.
He didn't really know. I mean,
you better have a good answer.
The pastor was able to tell us that the church had gotten a call from the Religious Affairs Bureau about 20 years previous saying, "We have your bell," and it had been taken away during the Cultural Revolution and used in a factory. And in the 90s, somehow they decided, well, we're going to give the church their bell back. But, you know, so that was interesting. But I was also curious, how did it get from Coffeyville, Kansas to
wondering about.
To China? But in the meantime, I turned to the pastor and I asked him, I said, "How did the bell survive the Great Leap Forward," which was a political campaign in China in the 50s, where they essentially melted all the metal down?
Mm-hmm.
And he said to me, he said, "Oh, they tried to burn it, but it was too strong."
Wow.
And wow. I thought, oh, just like the church in China.
Uh-huh.
They tried to burn it. It was too strong. So that was the point for me at which the bell became a symbol for God's faithfulness to the church in China. And I thought, if there's one bell with this story, there's got to be other bells around the country mm-hmm. with the same story. So in the last 6 months before I moved back to the States, I traveled around China to an Orthodox church, to several Catholic churches and several Protestant churches, and I found other bells that had really similar stories. And then I did – when I came back, I went, well, how did it get to from Coffeyville? And we did discover that there was a missionary from the church, First Baptist Church in Coffeyville, that was working in China in 1911, and the church had shipped the bell to
wow.
China.
What a great story.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. Okay, let's get back a little bit, if we can, to some of the activities happening in China. Maybe you could share some of the newest challenges that face Christians in China.
I would say one of the newest challenges right now is that the political environment in China is beginning to tighten. And the political environment